Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
I went to my mom and said, you know how I was talking about being a doctor? And yes, Ricky, we're so proud, you know? And it's like, well, I kind of changed my mind, you know? And you go, oh? You know? And I go, yeah. Well, what is it you would like to do now? And I said, well, I want to make monsters. And, you know, I want to be a monster maker. And she says, well, I don't think that's really a profession, Ricky.
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and if you've ever wondered how to turn a 6-foot-tall man into a 12-foot alien bug, join me as I discuss making movie monsters with makeup artist, all-around special effects wizard, and genuinely nice guy, Rick Baker. Rick found a passion for crafting creatures at a very young age, going on to become the most prolific and celebrated special effects makeup artist in Hollywood. He's created the iconic looks for some of the biggest blockbusters in science fiction history, including Star Wars, Men in Black, Batman. He has won 7 Academy Awards for Best Makeup and Hairstyling and has set the gold standard for masterful craftsmanship, all with a quiet humility. We cover it all in this talk, how Rick's first foray into monster making terrorized his parents, how mentors from the early days of film encouraged and influenced him, and why he needed to put bullet holes into his best friends. So sit back and listen to the unmasking of Rick Baker. Here we go.
Rick Baker, thanks for joining me on this podcast. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Adam?
Very good, sir. I'm curious, what is the first fantasy science fiction film that really captured your imagination?
I grew up very lower middle class, and we didn't go to the movies very often, but we did have a television set. And my introduction to, you know, science fiction and fantasy and horror films really came from the television set. You know, I was that first generation of kids to grow up in front of the box. And I think every state in America had on the weekend had a horror show host and showed basically the same movies all around the country. And you know, kids of my generation, we call ourselves monster kids. You know, we grew up watching those horror movies and science fiction and fantasy films on the weekend and read famous monsters and really got hooked on that kind of stuff. So it was more television than in actual movie theaters. But I do vividly remember going to the drive-in with my parents, mm-hmm. and there was a re-release of King Kong when Godzilla came out. It started out with Godzilla, the double bill, and I kind of fell asleep partway through Godzilla, I think, because it was past my bedtime. And so Godzilla was actually the one I remember seeing, and I thought it was King Kong. So, you know, it was like on a Saturday night, and my parents were sleeping in on Sunday morning, and I decided I was going to make a King Kong costume, but I was, you know, thinking of Godzilla. I actually got out some cardboard and, you know, a paper bag, and, you know, I cut out some of those, you know, Godzilla fins for my back and, you know, made this kind of paper bag mask. And, you know, when my parents finally got up, I went, you know, look what I made. I made King Kong, you know, and I was like, well, no, actually you made Godzilla. You didn't make it through King Kong.
How old were you?
I don't know. I was pretty young. Whenever that, you know, came out sometime in the 50s, I was born in 1950, you know, but still, you know, liked making stuff.
Wow.
I also vividly remember going to the drive-in and seeing the Ray Harryhausen film, 20 Million Miles to Earth, the one with the emir that comes, you know, the spaceship crashes from its trip to Venus, and that cool little reptilian creature, you know, claws its way out of that gelatinous kind of egg, and, you know, a little kid finds it, and I loved that. You know, I was a big Harryhausen fan.
Was there a moment in your childhood when you latched on to the idea that you wanted to do this, that you wanted to contribute to this genre?
There was a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland,
and it had a painting of Lon Chaney Sr. as the Phantom of the Opera. And I grabbed this thing off the rack and was like flipping through the pages, and this was like a dream come true. This was everything that I was interested in this one magazine. And there was also an article in there by some makeup artist I never heard of before or since. It called Boy into Monster, and he made this kid into this monster that pretty much looked like he hit him in the face with a pie and put a ping pong ball eye on him. But it looked so real, you know. And in the magazine, you know, Famous Monsters, they would not only talk about, you know, the directors and actors, but they would talk about the people behind the scenes, you know, the Ray Harryhausens and the Willis O'Briens and the Jack Pierces and William Tuttles and those kind of people that do the makeup. And I mean, I used to say to my mom that I wanted to be a doctor. That's what as a kid, I kept saying, I want to be a doctor when I grew up. And they were really proud of that fact. And you know, because none of my family really went to college or were like professional kind of people. And I was, you know, I happily, anytime I had to go to the doctor, I was happy to go because I was interested in that. But the reality was I wanted to be Dr. Frankenstein. I in my little stupid kid brain, you know, that's what, you know, those were the guys that made the monsters, you know, kind of. And I wanted to have a laboratory with all the Kenneth Strickfaden machines, you know, and you know, make monsters. And it wasn't until I was about 10 years old, and this is, like, again, around the time that I found the Famous Monsters of Filmland, that I kind of made the career change, you know. And I'll never forget that day that, you know, that I told my mother. I mean, I was so fortunate to have the parents that I had. I mean, besides being very loving, and they were very understanding and supportive. And, you know, I went to my mom and said, you know how I was talking about being a doctor? And, yes, Ricky, we're so proud, you know. And it's like, well, I kind of changed my mind, you know. And I go, oh? You know, and I go, yeah. Well, what is it you would like to do now? And I said, well, I want to make monsters. And, you know, I want to be a monster maker. And she says, well, I don't think that's really a profession, Ricky, you know. And I said, no, it is. It is. You know, there's this guy, Jack Pierce at Universal, who made Frankenstein and the Wolfman and the Mummy. And, you know, there's a, you know, a guy named Ray Harryhausen who does the stop motion stuff. And people really do this. And that's what I want to do. And she said, well, you know, I'm sure that if you worked real hard, you know, you can do anything that you set your mind to. And I believe her, you know, that she said I could do it. And if I worked hard at it, and she was right.
Amazing. Was it the character or the genre or the technology of the makeup that captured your imagination?
Well, I mean, first it was the character. I mean, I just was fascinated by the monsters. And, you know, and I like, and you know, I still am, and I, you know, I love those classic Universal horror films and the classic sympathetic monsters. You know, Frankenstein's a very sympathetic monster. The, you know, Quasimodo, the Charles Lawton Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, it's such a brilliant film and great performance. And, you know, I just like fell in love with these characters, and I fell in love with the way they looked. I knew that they didn't really look like that, but they looked so real, you know, and I liked fooling people with makeup, and right. I mean, I say this, I've said this so many times, but it really did happen. I mean, like, when I was a little kid and I made myself up like Frankenstein, nobody was really fooled by it, and then it would be like, oh, isn't that cute? Ricky made himself up like Frankenstein. It's like, no, that's not the response you're supposed to have. You know, you're supposed to be afraid.
Right, right.
You know? So, I mean, the first time I did a gash on my hand and showed my mother, she freaked out, and so I went through this blood and guts period of making up, you know, horrible wounds on myself and my friends and scaring their parents. I mean, it also got to the point where kids in the neighborhood weren't allowed to play with me anymore because I was that weird kid that would put a bullet hole in their head and then send them home.
That's awesome. Are you thinking about perhaps anatomy and form, the movement of the face and how it fits on the actor's face when you're designing a makeup?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, I learned makeup on my own face.
Yeah.
I'm the first person that I ever made up, you know, because I was there,
right.
You know, and I discovered the very first time I made myself up, and this was just, you know, white grease paint and black grease paint. You know, I did, you know, painted my face white, put black circles around my eyes, basically, and that face looking back at me in the mirror was no longer, you know, little Ricky Baker, you know, it was the scary vampire guy, you know, mm-hmm. And when you're looking out of your eyes into a, you know, a reflection, and that reflection that's looking back at you isn't really you anymore, it's a really interesting feeling.
Yeah. Well, and you must have seen with actors that you've worked with over the years, that same transformation that you felt, them looking into the mirror into a makeup you've collaborated with them on, seeing a whole different character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I love it. I mean, you have actors who really embrace that, who want to become a different character and want to look different for a part. And one of those was Eddie Murphy. The first time I worked with Eddie was Coming to America. Eddie played a whole bunch of different characters, one of them being an old Jewish man. And that was quite an extreme change. You know, I was very worried about doing that makeup, actually. And I insisted that we get Eddie so I could do a test for this old Jewish man makeup. And it was something like 15 different foam rubber pieces. It's weird when you put, you know, I think one of the first pieces I put on is like a cheek piece and just kind of this weird patch of rubber that doesn't look like anything yet. But Eddie looked at himself in the mirror, even with just this one cheek on, and he started moving his face around just to see what it would take to move it and make it work. And I was going, oh, this is a good sign. You know, he's actually getting into this, you know. And by the time I had the makeup finished, he just said, I can't believe how real this looks. He said, I want to improvise a scene. So I had a video camera and I, you know, pointed it in. We kept him in front of, in the makeup chair looking in the mirror because he was looking at this face that he wasn't used to, and just tried different performances with it and had fun with it. You know, he loved looking like somebody else. He enjoyed it, and he saw, you know, this other face looking back, you know, through his eyes, and it changed, you know, the way he felt about himself as this character.
You really do it all, Rick. From turning Eddie Murphy into an old Jewish man to creating hundreds of aliens for the Men in Black franchise. Is it fair to say hundreds of aliens over the three films?
Over the three films, yeah, that would work. I think we had more than 100 in the last film.
When you're creating an alien, a new alien for a film like that, are you looking to bring humanity out, or are you looking to bring simply character out in the design?
Yeah, a little bit of both. You know, I mean, again, on the first Men in Black, they said, we want to see something like we've never seen before. You know, I read it, and first of all, I felt that it's a film about an agency that, you know, polices the alien life on Earth. In the original script, Will's introduction to aliens on Earth took place in a bar, and Tommy Lee Jones at this point was trying to recruit him, and he's telling him that there were aliens everywhere and that the bartender Chucky was an alien. And in the script said, Tommy Lee Jones' character says, you know, show him Chucky. And the script said, you know, Chucky lifts up his neck and light comes out, you know. And that was one of the big scenes in the film. And I said, well, I want to see something. I mean, this is a scene where you should really see something that's the coolest thing you've ever seen, not just a light coming out of his neck.
Right, right.
And then it's like, well, what would you do? You know, so, you know, I thought about it for a while. And it was like, okay, how about if he says, show him Chucky, and then Chucky looks from side to side, and then his face opens up, and there's a little green man in there pulling little levers, and you have TV screens inside his head that's seeing what he's seeing out of his eyes, and then he, like, pulls a lever, and the face slams shut, you know, and they went, that's great, we love that, you know, so we went about doing that, and trying to have some kind of logic to why this thing would have gills, or, you know, or antenna, or whatever. And one of the problems I had on that film was the Edgar bug played by Vincent D'Onofrio is supposed to be like, you know, 12 feet tall or whatever, you know, peels the skin off of this guy and then puts it on like an Edgar suit. And I kept saying, how does he fit? How does a 12-foot tall bug fit into a 6-foot tall man, you know, and not totally distort him into ridiculous shape? And they would say, well, you know, he folds up. And I went, yeah, but his forearm is 4 feet long, you know, and you fold that up to the upper arm, it's still 4 foot long, and it's longer than the arm that's going to go in, you know. We have to figure out some way that this happened. I suggested when the Edgar bug is in Vincent D'Onofrio's skin, you know, the wife says, you know, Edgar, your skin is hanging off your bones or whatever it is, and there's supposed to be a shot. He looks in the mirror, and in the script it says he adjusts his loose neck, you know. And I said, that's not cool enough, you know. It's like, why don't we have him, like, grab on the back of his head and pull it tight, and you kind of see this alien form underneath? And we went with that, you know, but...
Yeah, I found that terrifying. I remember watching that.
I actually glued silk organza onto Vincent's cheeks, with the silk organza glued to the skin, and came up to this, like, top knot on the top of his head, which was a whole silicone piece that he wore anyways, and he could grab onto this thing and pull it and really stretch his face into that expression. And because Vincent was way into being Edgar, and I thought he was brilliant as him, he went for it, and he stretched his face beyond what I thought a human could do, you know? So, I mean, it was great. Again, Vincent was one of those actors I just loved working with, because when I was doing the initial designs, trying to think what this human skin, this empty human skin would look like in this alien form, I was thinking of stuff where I had, you know, silk glued on his face and pulled it, actually distorted his real skin, you know, and had plumpers in his dentures that distorted his mouth, and I was going to glue his eyelid down. And then I thought, you know, not many actors would actually let me do this to them. I called him up and I said, you know, I want you to come out and look at what I'm thinking of doing for your makeup so we can discuss it.
Right, to get him used to it.
Yeah, and just to see if he'd actually put up with it, you know. And you know, first of all, you know, when he saw the design, he loved it. And then I go, well, you know, it's not going to be really comfortable. You know, I got to be honest with you, because what I want to do is glue your eyelid down so your lower eyelid is going to be pulled down, you know, for the entire shoot, you know. He goes, yeah, that sounds great. You know, so I said, all right, let me just glue it down right now so you can see. Because I said, I don't really want to be in love with this design and then not be able to do it. You know, I glued it down, and he said, is there any way that you can pull it down farther? You know, it was like, I think I love you, Vincent, you know. So, he was up for anything. You know, he wanted more than what I was going to do. You know, can you build, like, you know, braces for my body so it's really difficult for me to move, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Oh.
So, you know, it was a real pleasure to work with him.
I can see that working with an actor is a key part of the process, but how do you go about designing an entirely unique character, one that's never been seen or dreamt of before?
Well, that's always a problem, isn't it? I mean, that's what they always ask for now, too, you know? And when I worked on the first Star Wars, it was a lot easier because there weren't that many films with aliens in them up until that time, you know? And then, you know, we had this cantina full of aliens, and after Star Wars, every movie that came out had a cantina full of aliens, and people were exploring all these different designs, you know. And then there was, you know, the Star Trek TV shows with, you know, all these aliens and all this stuff. And it just gets harder and harder to do things like nobody's ever seen, you know.
Right.
But I would start, you know, in the old days, it was, you know, with a pencil and paper, and would just kind of scribble down some ideas, you know. And the problem was I drew as a kid, and I mostly drew monsters, you know, and I got better and better because it really, when I decided this is what I wanted to do, I knew that I was going to have to design things and show people things and get them to, like, understand what I'm thinking I'm going to build, you know, because it takes time to build this stuff. And
makeup artists need to be artists first. I mean, you are an accomplished draftsperson and also painter and sculptor.
Thanks, Adam. But back in the old days, like when I did Schlock, which was my second film, which was John Landis's first film, I did basically two drawings. And it was like, do you like this one or do you like this one? You know, and you go, oh, I like that one. You know, and go, okay, that's what I'm going to make. But I wasn't as good of a draftsman as I wanted to be. And the image in my head was usually better than the drawing. You know, I could see it better in my head. I just couldn't translate it into paper as well. And, you know, it always evolved as you were doing the sculpture and working on it. And it evolved in a good way, I think. But
as you create these amazing works, of course, you're building on the techniques of artists that came before you. Who pioneered this art form?
Lon Chaney Sr., who did some really amazing makeups with very crude materials. I mean, he didn't have foam rubber. He didn't even have rubber in those days. And he did things out of, you know, nose putty and collodion, which is this kind of liquidy plastic stuff that, you know, very acetone, you know, as a solvent, quite harsh on your skin. But he would use, you know, collodion and spirit gum and cotton and build up cheekbones that way and things. And also would do things to distort his face, like he glued silk organza on the tip of his nose and pulled it up and stuck it on his forehead and on his nose and pulled his whole nose up like that and built up his cheekbones out of cotton and collodion and had a cool set of teeth and, you know, glued his ears flat to his head and had this kind of padded bald pate that he put on his head and a wig and became the Phantom of the Opera. And it's a brilliant makeup and it's a brilliant performance. I mean, Phantom of the Opera is great. And yeah, he did torturous things to himself, you know, but they were great, you know, so that's how it started out. But the real change came in 1939 when people started using foam latex. And The Wizard of Oz was one of the first uses of foam latex, as was The Hunchback of Notre Dame, both films being made in 1939. I mean, that was pretty much the state of the art
up until we started doing pieces out of silicone, silicone gel-filled pieces, you know, in a fairly recent, you know, movie history. Yeah.
Right. Are there other makeup artists that you are inspired by or who have shown you things you didn't know were possible?
Yeah. When I was trying to learn, there wasn't the internet and there were libraries. I went to my local library and there was a book called The Technique of Film and Television Makeup. I was looking through it and there were certain makeups that just jumped off the page that just looked so real. And every one of those, that one looks great. And it would be by Dick Smith, you know, and that's when I became, you know, this hardcore Dick Smith fan.
Dick Smith, of course. It does not get any more iconic than the man who did Taxi Driver, The Godfather, The Exorcist. I'm curious what it was that drew you to his work.
This guy, just his work just looks more real than anybody else's, you know. And as a kid, I think it was in the 7th or 8th grade, we had to do some project where we had to look up somebody in Who's Who in America and write a report about him. And I thought, you know, I'll look up Dick Smith, and I didn't really expect him to be in there, but he was. And also in there was his address. So I wrote this address down on a piece of paper. But I was still, you know, Dick Smith was a god to me, and I was afraid to write him a letter. But when I graduated from high school, my parents said, well, this summer we're gonna go to New York, where I was born. I remembered, you know, it was like New York. You know, wait, Dick Smith is not in New York, you know. So I got out that piece of paper, which I'd saved all these years. And I go, okay, it's now or never. I'm gonna write Dick Smith a letter. So I wrote him a letter, enclosed some, you know, Polaroids that I took of some of the masks that I made and makeups that I had done, and a lot of them were actually copies of things that Dick had done. Sent it off to Dick Smith, and then every day I'd go to the mailbox to see if I get a reply. And in an amazingly short amount of time, I got a reply. I opened up the mailbox, and there was a letter addressed to me that had Dick's return address on it. And I, you know, my heart was beating really fast, you know, and it was spongy. There was something in the envelope that was like spongy, like rubber, you know. So I opened it up, and there was actually a reject foam appliance of this Quasimodo makeup that I had copied from Dick's original mold, and this amazing letter that said, not only, you know, would I be willing to meet with you, he goes, I can't wait to meet with you, you know, I've never seen work like this from anybody, let alone an 18-year-old self-taught kid. You know, I can't wait for you to come. Mm. You know, so that was pretty exciting.
Wow.
In the very beginning of our 2-week trip to New York, I went to Dick Smith's house. My parents drove me to Dick's house in Larchmont. And he said, first thing he did was send my parents away. He goes, you know, I want to spend the day with Rick. You guys go away. I'll get him back somehow. Mm. You know, and it's like, I really expected, you know, to be like, there for half an hour or something, you know, and it truly was a whole day. And then one of the first things he did after my parents left is he gave me like a yellow legal pad and a pen. And he goes, I find that I remember things better if I write them down, and I'm going to tell you a lot of stuff. So you should write it down. It's like, okay, you know, and he just told me, you know, answered any question I had and, you know, gave me formulas for stuff. He gave me actually texture pads, you know, like, which is, you know, like a little rubber, you know, like we used to, you know, you paint latex on an orange and you could use that as a way to texture pores on a clay sculpture.
Right.
But he had a bunch of cool texture pads that he'd taken off of, you know, old leather gloves and things like that, you know, and just gave me all this information that, it was totally information overload, but I was so excited.
Incredible.
As soon as I got back, I mean, the first thing I did is I sculpted an old man mask with this new knowledge that I got from Dick and using the texture pads. And it was, you know, 200% better than anything I'd done previous. And we would correspond. You know, Dick said, anytime you have any question, you know, you can write me or call me. And,
wow.
No, we just had this, you know, great collaboration where we'd help each other out too. You know, mostly it was Dick helping me out, but I occasionally would tell him a few things that I did. I remember when I did a film called It's Alive, which has this baby monster. I sent him pictures and he goes, I don't see any seams on it. Where are the seams? You know, and I said, well, this is what I did, you know, and I trimmed them deep and then I filled them in with this different latex and then I, you know, tried to retexture it. And he goes, that's brilliant. I never would have thought of that.
And, impressing a mentor with your technique, that is indeed a memory to treasure.
Mm-hmm.
You have so much great work to look back on, and I know you've gone and recast some of the original molds you made for Star Wars. I want to know, how did it feel when you pulled those castings out?
And it was a really weird, nostalgic feeling to, first of all, even see the molds again, you know, and there was such an excitement
You know, when I first started making masks, when you peel that rubber out of the mold and see a mask that you made, you know, and it's just so exciting. And I still had that same feeling, you know, that this many years later, pulling these things out, seeing it, you know, again with like fresh eyes after, you know, 40 some odd years, you know.
And, yeah. Well, and I know you're also embracing drawing digitally, drawing characters and faces digitally, and then realizing them with 3D printing and other, like, absolutely cutting-edge technology.
Yeah, well, I said to myself as a kid, I'm going to make sure I stay current, you know? Mm-hmm. And plus, I just think it's fun, you know, and fun to try new ways. Hmm. I heard about ZBrush, which had just come out, and I did this one tutorial. And, okay, I get it right now. And again, loved it. It was like you had a chunk of digital clay that you could push around and carve into and add to. And,
wow.
You know, when you're drawing, it was never really exactly what I had in my head, but sometimes the sketch itself was like, looked like a good sketch, but it wasn't quite the idea I was thinking of. And it's like, do I destroy a good sketch and try to change it, or do I leave it alone? You know, and I had done both. I've screwed up good drawings and I've changed them and made them better, you know, but it's always a little bit scary. But digitally doing it, I called it no fear painting. You could try things and you could always go back, you know, or you could take the eyes off of one and put it on another one. And I instantly love that.
That amount of freedom.
Oh, yeah. It's really cool to be able to model something digitally again because you can save versions of it. You can go back, you know, you can cut and paste and things like that. And it was fun.
Rick, we are almost out of time, but I have a short lightning round of either or questions for you.
Okay, let's see if I can actually answer one.
Human or alien?
Alien. For sure.
King Kong or Godzilla?
King Kong, no doubt, yeah.
Wolverine or Edward Scissorhands?
Ooh, I think Edward Scissorhands.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah.
The Upside Down or Middle Earth?
I'd say Middle Earth, just because my friend Peter Jackson did those movies and I got up.
Yeah, I'm right there with you too. Reboot or original?
Original.
Rick, I really appreciate you spending time giving us an insight into makeup and sci-fi fantasy character building. It's been really illuminating. Thank you.
Well, it's nice talking to you, Adam.
My thanks to Rick Baker, and thanks again for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. Be sure to check out our other episodes with wonderful guests like DC Fontana, Ron Moore, Chris Hardwick, and Frank Oz. For more about the podcast, visit sci-fi.com.